Okay, we'll come to order. The first thing I'd like to do is, I forgot, is Mel, yes. Melanie Lacombe is, I think, going to be at our committee meeting as usual. She's the CA for Representative Paymar's committee, so there's so much interaction. You should probably be working with her also on bills. Then the second thing is, I want to thank Asia for all her work. I think this is probably your last committee. Your presence will be here in our memory. And good luck with the State Department. For those who weren't there this morning, and we went to, in Paymar's committee, we went to the DCA, and I see Representative Cornish isn't here this afternoon. He got so excited when we went into the, what was it, 4,500 the guns that they have in a room there, that he's probably just thought he went to heaven.
Mr. Chair, I do believe they pushed him too as they left.
So today we have what'll be, I think, a really interesting for members of this committee. It's a forensics overview from the department, and then we have things, and much of it was also given in a seminar to attorney generals and other prosecutors, so you're going to be understanding a lot of the things that come up in court cases, and I think it's important for this committee to understand the effects of the laws that we pass and how that then carries forward, and it's really important when you're thinking of what to do on laws. And then in the end, then we have might be called the other side. We have Pat Sullivan from the Hennepin County Public Defender's Office, and I'm not sure of his biggest fame, claim to fame, but I know he was a consultant on the by the defense on the O.J. Simpson trial, but we're not going to have him talking about that, even though it's probably really interesting. And I know he's had some other nationally published in science magazines on DNA, and he's considered probably the top, by far, defense lawyer in the state on DNA. So he can explain some of the other issues also with forensics. So, Frank, if you want to just come up, we have a quorum, so let's, Representative Olin moves the minutes from the last meeting. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Okay, passed. Frank, you can just start and go ahead, and you've got a... some people with you, I'm sure.
Yes. Good morning, Chairman. My name is Frank Dolish. It's D-O-L-E-J-S-I for the record. I'm the laboratory director for the BCA Forensic Science Service. A number of you were here at the BCA earlier today and got a tour, and you've seen a little bit of the science behind forensic science, and so this afternoon what we want to look at is the forensic part of that, and that is the interaction of science with the courts and some of the issues relating to forensic science and the BCA lab. And as you indicated, some of this was presented at a Attorney General's CLE course earlier this year. And I brought some of my staff this morning that I'm going to have actually do these presentations. This committee should know that it's not just me that makes the BCA. It's really the staff that makes the BCA and the science here. So up first, we have Susan Gross, who is the supervisor of our chemistry group, who is going to be talking about a recent Supreme Court decision called Caulfield. We'll be talking a little bit, and Jim Iverson will talk about a appellate court decision regarding the DNA arrestee database law. Brent Nelson from our toxicology group will be talking about some discovery issues around the intoxilizer and the source code issue. Glenn Langenberg, one of our latent print examiners, is here to talk a little bit about admissibility and fry issues that we're encountering in the comparative sciences. And if we have time at the last, I'll spend a little bit of time talking about the status of the Forensic Laboratory Advisory Board. If we don't get that far, I did have a handout that was will be passed out that just lets you know who the appointees to that board are and when their first meeting is going to be.
Thank you. Just to assume the position that the defense isn't going to take any time in this case.
We get along. Susan, if you can come up and...
Good afternoon. Again, can everybody hear me okay?
Yep.
Okay. Again, my name is Susan Gross. I'm the supervisor of the chemistry group, and I'm going to talk about the Caulfield decision and how it affects the BCA. And this was a decision that came down, or was decided October 5th, 2006, so it's very recent. And I'm just going to give briefly talk about just some background, some things, some statutes that are involved with this decision. The first one is the Minnesota Statute 634.15, and it states that the results of BCA lab results authorized by the BCA are admissible into evidence. And it provides that the defendants may cross-examine the analyst at trial by notifying the prosecuting attorney 10 days before the trial. Another piece of background information, the Sixth Amendment, which is, you know, the speedy and public trial that a defendant is entitled to, also in there, which I highlighted, they're also to be confronted with the witnesses against him, which plays into this Caulfield. And the third is Crawford. I don't want to, that's different than Caulfield. That's kind of why I had the PowerPoint presentation, because they kind of sound alike. Well, Crawford was in the state of Washington. And some brief history is what happened was Michael Crawford was tried for an assault and attempted murder. And during his trial, a tape that the police had, that his wife had made, it was during the, right after the assault, the police came and separated the husband and the wife, and they took statements from both of them after Miranda warning, and they taped this. Well, in the state of Washington, a spouse does not have to testify against another spouse. So they didn't have her testify, but they took that tape and admitted it into court. Michael Crawford was found guilty, but then he appealed it, and the U.S. Supreme Court decision was that this relates to the Sixth Amendment, the Confrontation Clause, and it gives the right to the defendant the right to confront witnesses and cross-examine their testimony, whereas in this case they weren't able to cross-examine because it was just the audio tape. And again, this includes the testimony that the police gathered. So then that brings us up to Caulfield. So Scott Caulfield was arrested, and he was put, he denied a jury trial, but it was in front of a judge. And this was a drug case, and the drug report, the BCA drug report, was admitted underneath that statute. And the chemist was not called to testify because the defense did not request this. Well, during the trial, the defense objected to the admission of the lab report based on Crawford. The district court admitted the report without giving reason, and the court found Caulfield guilty of possession of controlled substance with intent to sell. So then it was brought forward to the Court of Appeals, and they recognized that the BCA lab report could be testimonial, but they did not decide the issue. They found that even though the court might have abused its discretion in admitting the report, Its admission was harmless beyond reasonable doubt. So then Caulfield brought it to the Minnesota Supreme Court and challenged it and argued that BCA report identifying cocaine was testimonial under the Crawford versus Washington, and it violated his rights of the confrontation. And also that there was an error in admitting the report because it was not harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, and therefore he was requesting a reverse and a remand for a new trial. So the state's argument was that the BCA's report is not testimonial because it is not similar to the testimonial statements provided by Crawford. It has nothing to do with prior testimony or police interrogation. And there's a difference between a fact witness and a BCA analyst who only provides foundational testimony. And they also argued that the analyst who prepares the report is not directly involved in the police investigation. So the ruling of the Minnesota Supreme Court was that the BCA lab report was testimonial. And this notice and demand statute, which is that Minnesota statute 34.15, imposes an unreasonable burden on the defendant's confrontational rights. Like I said that before, like that Minnesota statute says that if the defense lets the prosecution know 10 days before the trial to have the analyst come. And then also the error in admitting the BCA, they ruled, was not harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. So the decision was reversed and remanded for a new trial. So that is the Caulfield decision. So how does that affect the BCA? Basically, courts won't be willing to stipulate to a report. That's what we used to do under the Minnesota statute, was if the defense and the prosecution agreed, they would allow the report to be admitted. And this happened very often with drug chemistry cases and toxicology cases. Often the reports are very simple. They're stating like 1 gram of methamphetamine. So there wasn't any issues until they stipulated. Where now, they are not tending to do that. Basically, it's time and money that it's really affecting the BCA. And again, this has only been 3 months, but already we are noticing a difference. One, we're getting a lot more subpoenas are being issued. Already since then, like in the 3 months, they've doubled. I mean, the scientists in the drug section, toxicology section, can get 20 subpoenas in 1 week. And how we handle subpoenas is first come, first serve. So the first one for the day that we have received, that we will honor that one and try to work, you know, to honor all the others, but we can only be in one place at one time. So this has also caused the scientists to be on the phone a lot to the prosecutors. One, trying to educate them that this Caulfield decision is kind of a notification issue. You know, if they give enough time to the defense and notify them, and also, again, like I said, dealing with multiple subpoenas for 1 day. And also, we have also started getting subpoenas even before we get the evidence, because some of these county attorneys know, you know, how many subpoenas we get, and if we get their subpoena first, we will honor theirs first. And again, the scientists work very hard to try to work with the attorneys, and, you know, if I'll be in Todd County this morning, and if I can get on, I'll, you know, be able to be in Dodge County this afternoon. Again, we're spending more time testifying. And even though our testimony might be very short, might be only 15 minutes, and if it's in Hennepin County, that is fine. But if it's in, you know, a southeastern Minnesota, you know, it takes you 3.5 hours to get there. And so, again, it's a lot of time away from the lab, which is affecting our backlog. So we're anticipating an increase in the backlog because if scientists aren't in the lab, cases aren't getting done. And then the second thing is money. It's costing the state more money with having the scientists, you know, be away from the lab, paying the mileage, and things like that. So far, those are the effects that we have seen in the short amount of time that this Caulfield decision has taken place.
Representative Beamer?
Thank you, Ms. Chair. Just a clarification, because I'm confused about the Crawford case. What that, when you use the word testimonial, what does that include? So, or what does that include or exclude? I mean, is a police report, is a 911 call, a dispatch tape? I mean, is that That's excluded in Crawford, right? So what does testimonial mean?
Ms. Groff?
Chairman, representative. It's my understanding that the testimonial does include that, but it also includes more. It included the tapes that the wife made, the interview tapes, and the testimonial. I don't know.
Okay.
Representative Famer, do you have a
I read Crawford, but I don't understand. I guess I'm just trying to find out what maybe some of the learned attorneys here could tell me what the testimonial means. No.
Whatever a judge wants it to mean in his courtroom.
You start wondering if that isn't the case, whatever they decide it's going to mean.
As I've been told many times by judges, the law in this courtroom means whatever I say it means. Are there any other questions?
Chairman Mulray, Representative Pimar, just so this group knows, so the people that we have testifying today are scientists, that we are not lawyers, and so that might be a question that you pose to counsel or to the Attorney General's office. It's just, we're responding to our interaction with this, and I understand from the County Attorneys Association that they may have some language that they're going to bring forward to try to address this issue.
Well, thank you, Mr. Dolish, I know, and it's in Representative Pimer's committee, but it affects all of us, and I'm sure that we're going to be asking the public defenders also for something in this, because we want to be able to have people get their proper defense, but there's a certain limit on dollars for things, and we've got to figure out how to do that, and I'm sure Representative Pimer will be having that in his committee as an issue. Are there any more questions of Ms. Gross? Representative Holberg?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Gross, what you mentioned your backlog. What is your backlog at this time?
Chairman Mulray, Representative, currently the drug section's backlog is approximately 3 months. So once the case comes in, it'll be 3 months until the report is issued. The various sections do vary. I know the drug chemistry section because I'm the supervisor. I'm also supervisor of the trace evidence, and the trace evidence section is about approximately the same.
And Mr. Chair, just a follow up. So, what is your are your departments the worst or the best, or do you? I mean, I know you're just speaking on behalf of your departments, but do you have any feel for how many other departments there are and what their backlogs are?
Chairman Mulray, Representative, I am just speaking on with behalf, because I know the drug section, there's other sections, the biology section, the tox section, and I do not know their backlogs.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Representative Hellstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you happen to know if any other states are running into the same challenge, and if they are coming up with any solutions like video conferencing for the courtroom or any of that, so you could actually stay in one area and actually do that through the court? I mean, is anyone doing anything like that, you know?
Chairman Mulray, Representative. No, I don't know of any other states that are, but we have started. I have contacted three counties, and we have testified one time via teleconferencing. It was a county out in southwestern Minnesota, which would have taken like 4 hours to drive there. And so it has worked, and three counties are on board with this.
Any more questions? Are there any other further questions to Ms. Gross? Okay.
Chairman Mulray, the next issue and person will be our DNA, one of our DNA supervisors, Jim Iverson, who will talk about an appellate court decision regarding the DNA database.
Okay. While he's getting up here, Representative Cornish, I just want to mention, now that you're here, there was concern for you. You're good before you got here. We were wondering if Somebody mentioned you might be having a heart attack out of excitement at seeing all those guns in one room this morning.
Looks like
you're done. 4,500 different types of guns. Then somebody else asked if you were auditioning for a rerun of the Bad Masterson show yesterday.
I got called wide open about 4 seconds.
I'm sorry, Mr. Iverson, but you can, after that, can you make your presentation?
Mr. Chair, okay. Thank you, Representative. My name is Jim Iverson. I'm a supervisor from the DNA unit at the BCA laboratory. Actually, one of two supervisors in that unit. My specific areas are in the mitochondrial DNA laboratory, which many of you were able to see this morning. But I'm here actually to talk about some other duties that I deal with the offender database. Since 1990, January 1st of 1990, legislation has been passed to collect DNA from various people that have been convicted and in 2005 actually arrested on certain crimes. Since 1990, the statute has grown. Numerous offenses have been added to the legislation up until 2002, when this body passed legislation requiring the collection of all people convicted of a felony. Those statutes were not ongoing. They did have a sunset clause. So in 2005, legislation was passed making that permanent. In fact, it actually expanded the conviction statute in that now you didn't have to be convicted of a felony. You just had to have been charged with a felony and convicted of that offense or of any other offense that arose from that same set of circumstances. So it could be a gross misdemeanor or even a misdemeanor conviction requiring collection of DNA. As part of that, in 2005 as well, a predatory arrestee, as we called it, statute was imposed, that if you were arrested on a series of predatory crimes and you appeared in front of the court on a probable cause determination, they could require DNA testing at that time, so prior to conviction. That statute remained in effect until October 10th of last year, when the Court of Appeals ruled that portions of that statute were unconstitutional. Frank has said, I'm not a lawyer, so I'm not going to interpret the ruling, but for the most part it said that the level of probable cause needed to collect the sample didn't rise to the level that would have been needed for a search warrant, and so therefore it was an illegal search of that individual. So on October 10th, things kind of went into flux, if you will. We were trying to ask the Attorney General's office for an opinion, and we were told just put everything on hold. Don't take in any more samples that were collected from people that were arrested. Let's wait and see where this plays out, if it's going to be appealed to the Supreme Court or not. So on November 9th, we found out, no, it was not going to be appealed to the Supreme Court. So the ruling became, in effect, it became law. The law itself was unconstitutional. So now we have to go around and find out, well, numerous, I'd say a majority of these people that were arrested were ultimately convicted, so we should get their DNA sample, but we can't keep the arrestee sample that we have. It was an illegal sample. So now we've spent a great deal of time and energy trying to go to the various counties that submitted these samples to us, have them check to see if there was a conviction, and then collect a new sample. So it's been a pretty tremendous effort that we put forward to try and get this accomplished. I can't sit here now and say that we're completed. There were about 2,200 samples collected during that time, and they were in all phases of the process. So many of those have probably still not even been to trial, so we don't know where the conviction status is going to be at. I did just want to give you a few numbers just so you can see that the DNA database is truly doing what you as a body anticipated it would do. In 2001, when we count DNA hits, we count a hit to a database, we call it an investigation aided. In 2001, we had 14 investigations aided in the state of Minnesota and three with other states. To jump ahead, 2003, there were 43 in the state and six on the national database. 2005, we had 123 in the state and 27 on a national level. And last year, we had 232 investigations aided in the state and 45 national hits. So that's 277 investigations aided. So I think, and other states will tell you the same thing, as the databases have grown, we've seen a huge number of increases in the hits to the database. Some more numbers, we have about 67,000 samples that we've received to date since 1990. About 52,000 of those are actually in the search for database. The reason why there's a disparity, we do have about an 8,000 sample backlog that we're still working on. We're hitting that very hard, and I anticipate within a month or two that will be down to maybe 2,000 or 3,000. We also get duplicate samples, so we don't analyze the duplicates, but they're in that final number. So that's truly what I had to say. The arrestee statute, we are not accepting samples from that anymore.
Representative Johnson, I think you were first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When was it that you actually accessed the DNA database, then? What sort of crime situation do you actually go in and check to see if they have it? Yes.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I can tell you, if we have a case where we don't have an identified suspect, so we go through the DNA process and we are not able to say that a certain sample matches a suspect, we will search the database at that point and see if we can have, if we have a convicted offender in the database. At a later date, it goes up to the national. Like today is our date. I uploaded this morning to national. On Monday, they will do a search of the entire national database, and I will be notified at that point if there were any hits to the database.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I collect DNA samples where I work for cases, and they ask me why I'm taking it, and I tell them it's for, you know, rapes and murders or something like that. If you leave some DNA behind, you know, then we have some evidence. Is that those are the kind of cases that you don't do it for every time you have come across a possible DNA sample left behind? How do you determine when you're going to actually access the bank?
Mr. Iverson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I can tell you that the cases that we do are, the samples that we actually upload to the database from crime scene samples have to be at least, in our minds, to the perpetrator. They can't be, we cannot upload victims' crimes or victims' DNA. We can't upload what would be elimination, a boyfriend or a husband or something like that. That can't be uploaded. It has to be an unidentified profile or at least identified to the perpetrator that can be uploaded.
Representative Holber.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are your investigation aided numbers proportional to the number of samples that you have? I mean, you showed an escalation of the numbers, but as a percentage of the total samples, is it pretty constant, or is there an exponential growth to that?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I really can't give you the numbers. I can just tell you that it's been fairly constant. As the numbers of samples that go into the database increases, the number of investigations aided has increased. But is the ratio the same? I can't tell you. I don't know.
All right. And then, if I might, are there any DNA samples in your database that are required of people because of their occupations? Do you, for example, database law enforcement officials in this database?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I can tell you no. There are very strict rules that we have to follow to be part of the National Systems Health CODIS. We cannot database those types of samples in a searchable index that we would routinely look at for crime. We do keep a database of, say, our employees. We keep a database of some of our crime scene investigators that we will look at for what we call unexpected results to see if perhaps there was contamination. The issues with the testing that we're doing is incredibly sensitive, and so we want to make sure that we know that. So it's a voluntary process, but I would say 99% of the employees have agreed to that.
And if I might follow up, how many other states' databases does Minnesota have access to? Are you sharing across all 50 states, or do you tender and negotiate individual agreements with each state that you work with and share this data with?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Representative, virtually, I think all 50 states are tied into the national database, and then there are three federal agencies as well. We can also share data with other countries through Interpol. There's a mechanism that we could search Canada. We can search through some of the European countries. I think there are 27 different countries that can tie together if needed.
All right, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions for Mr. Iverson? Okay, then your next in presenter.
Mr. Chairman, the next individual that I'd like to do a short presentation is Brent Nelson, who is with our toxicology group, and this has to do with some discovery issues. I'll let him cover that.
Mr. Nelson.
My name is Brent Nelson. I'm a forensic scientist with the toxicology group. We do drug testing in blood and urine, and I also spent some time in the breath alcohol division, which is part of the toxicology group. Recently, the intoxilizer has come under a challenge, kind of migrated up from Florida to the source code that runs the intoxilizer. There is a case now, Underdahl versus the Commissioner of Public Safety, that's waiting to be heard by the Supreme Court on this issue. In this case, in the Underdahl case, there was no expert testimony taken. The defense attorney petitioned that his client had the right to examine the source code for any errors, also had the right to purchase an intoxilizer. The BCA procured and resold an intoxilizer due to that court order, been investigating avenues for the source code. CMI, the manufacturer of the intoxilizer, will not turn over the source code. Proprietary information. It's like asking Bill Gates to give you the source code of Windows. It's proprietary. There is a competitive nature in breath alcohol instruments. The instruments have been analytically tested, empirically tested. They're tested by the manufacturer. They're tested by the national government. The National Highway Traffic Safety Council has a conforming products list that many states look to, that the instrument has to be on that list before it can be used in evidentiary situations. It's also been rigorously tested by us at the BCA, analytically, subjecting it to different samples of different concentrations, and it reports accurately and reliably. The discovery challenge to the source code isn't really a challenge to the analytical accuracy and reliability of the results. It's a challenge to the discovery process. If you're not in possession of it, you can't turn it over, and therefore my client's rights have not been upheld, and the case should just go away. We cannot convince CMI to turn over the source code. Again, they do have a competitive business. They're based in Owensboro, Kentucky. We have no jurisdiction over them to compel them to turn it over. We're waiting for the Supreme Court decision. Whatever comes down could be very drastic to the breath test alcohol program. There's approximately 28,000 breath tests run a year. Those tests then would convert to blood or urine tests, which would drastically drive up our costs and turnaround time. In toxicology, the other issue we have is with the CVHs and CVI offenses. Last year, 169 was changed a little bit to include the word or metabolites when it's talking about Schedule 1 or 2 substances. That wasn't changed for criminal vehicular injury or homicide. So if there's any questions.
Representative Lush.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, the last I checked or heard about the relevant accuracy of the various tests is that it kind of went in the order of blood, breath, followed by urine. Is it true that the intoxilizer is still generally more accurate than a urine test?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Representative, good question. actually, blood and urine are analyzed the same way. And so the accuracy for a urine test is every bit of good, as good in a laboratory sense as the blood test. It comes with the interpretation of how much alcohol is deposited in the urine, trying to relate that back to a blood level at that time. Makes the urine a little more questionable. With a urine result, you can't back extrapolate to a previous time like you can with a blood or a breath test. In my eyes, all three of them are accurate and reliable, and the urine is tested as we do the blood, so the results we get are as accurate, but the interpretation is somewhat less off a urine sample. And breath is about the same as blood for the interpretative quality.
Are there any other questions of Mr. Nelson? Okay, next one.
Thank you, Chairman. The next individual that we have on the agenda, and you heard his presentation at the Attorney General CLE, is Glenn Langenberg. He is one of our scientists in the latent fingerprint section, and he's going to be talking about admissibility and FRI issues in relation to latent prints.
Mr. Chair, committee members, representatives, thank you for the opportunity to come down and speak to you today. Frank has asked me to talk about the recent court challenges that we've had to the forensic identification sciences. What are the forensic identification sciences? They would consist of fingerprint examinations, footwear examinations, tire tracks, handwriting comparisons. This is someone who determines whether or not a signature is authentic or a forgery or not. Firearms examinations, comparisons of bullets and spent cartridges, things like that. These are comparisons that are done by human beings where they're comparing one thing to another to see if there's a match. I'm a fingerprint examiner, so what I do on a daily basis, receive evidence into the BCA, examine it for the presence of latent prints. Latent just means hidden, so it's not a visible print on there. I have to develop it or visualize it in some way with chemicals or powders. I take that latent print and compare it to known exemplars, typically inked fingerprints or prints from a fingerprint card from a booking or an arrest record. And I compare those to one another to see if there's a match. Did this person touch this object? Did he leave his fingerprint at a scene that he had no business being at? So that's what I do. Now, you may have seen in television and movies that, you know, a fingerprint examiner scans into the computer. The computer cycles through millions of images of fingerprints, and then they overlay the two, and it blinks match, 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 and says 99.9% chance there's a match. That's not how it's done in the real world. In fact, you know, humans do these comparisons. They do it in their brain, and it comes with all the foibles and weaknesses of a human being doing it in their brain. But also has the strength of a human. Humans are much better at doing these types of comparisons, especially when they're distorted and fragmentary images, than a computer will. We haven't taught a computer how to do these types of comparisons yet. So that's a good thing. So these are some of the oldest forensic sciences. They've been around for 100 years, over 100 years. They've been in the courts for 100 years. We've been testifying to them for 100 years. What's the problem? Well, about 10, 15 years ago, they changed some admissibility laws at the federal level, and it's been filtering down to all these other courts, and there are different admissibility rules and laws and criteria, but essentially what's happening now is that we're being challenged on the admissibility of this type of evidence. In other words, it is typically prosecution is putting forward their DNA evidence or their fingerprint evidence in defense of saying, that's not admissible, it doesn't meet these criteria, it's not coming into the courtroom, you can't present that. So they have a pretrial hearing, admissibility hearing, before a judge, no jury present at that time, and the judge hears evidence from both sides to determine, is this essentially reliable and good evidence and should come into the courtroom? Which, in my opinion as a scientist, those are very fair questions. And we should be asking if these tests are reliable, and there are different criteria for determining those conditions of reliability. You know, what's your error rate? Is this a valid technique? You know, do you have a validation study? Do you have research to back this up? These are important questions, and I think these are good, valid questions that defense is raising. It is our job as forensic scientists to rise to that challenge and be able to show them, well, here's our data, here's our studies, here's our research that says this is a good, reliable method. So, when they asked us, the courts asked us for our reliability information, our studies and research, we really didn't have it. And that may be somewhat surprising or shocking, but let's put this in the proper perspective. When we look at DNA, you know, DNA grew up in a modern scientific era. You know, from the OJ case, that it was hotly contested, it was debated about the issues. They threw tons of money and research at DNA from academia, from the private sector, government, and everybody was researching DNA, and out of that they had blue ribbon panels to investigate this, develop standards, and out of all of that they became a great discipline, very solid, well-backed with research, so that when they had these challenges, no problem. They can meet those challenges. And they looked at us, and we didn't have those. Well, they said, well, DNA has all this. Where's your data? And so we had to really scramble and get those things. And there's a whole history to how this kind of happened, but remember, it's already been in the courts for 100 years before they had some of these admissibility standards. So we really are rising to that challenge now to meet that, and it's an important thing for us to do. But and we are doing that research, but you have to realize, too, the other thing that you've heard from Sue and some of the other scientists that have testified. I mean, I was hired to do casework. I mean, that's what I'm there at the BCA to do. That's my job, is to do casework. We have a backlog. We have to get those cases out. But we also have to meet this challenge. And, you know, those of us that are doing research, you know, we've stepped up to the plate to do these things, to address these issues, but many of us are coming in after hours, staying late, coming in on the weekends. I'm writing papers in my head when I'm on the airplane or in the shower. I mean, I'm constantly spending, you know, time, my own personal time, to do, you know, this research to meet these challenges. And I'm very fortunate to work at a laboratory like the BCA, where I have management like Frank and other managers that support us doing this research. And they are all for us doing this and provide us with, you know, the resources to do that and the support. But they also recognize we have to get our casework done, too. That's important. When investigators call me, you know, they're not calling me to ask for my most recent research project, the results of my research. They want to know, where's their case, where's the results, what's, you know, where's my DNA report? You know, you can do it on CSI in 10 minutes. Why is it taking you 2 to 3 months to get me this report? So that's a shift of focus for us, but we are definitely stepping up to do that. And we're also one of the only forensic science, in fact, as far as I know of, we're the only forensic science laboratory in Minnesota that is actually publishing these types of results and studies. I can't think of another lab in Minnesota in the last decade to have published in a professional journal. So they're looking to us to do this research as well. And when they're having hearings in Minneapolis and Hennepin on Minneapolis and Hennepin cases, and BCA is not involved, they're asking us to come down and testify and help them out, prepare for these hearings, and bring studies and data with us to support them. So, and it's not even in Minnesota as well. We're actually getting other states asking us to come and help them. We've had calls from Vermont and out east, and we'll come and help them out there as well. So this is a pretty serious thing. So the other thing to keep in mind, too, is, you know, balancing the casework and the research. If we can't get the evidence into the courtroom, the casework part is moot. I mean, if we can't actually get the results into the courtroom and pass the admissibility challenge, then doing the casework is a moot point, because they won't be able to get into the court. Now, and all it really does take, it just takes one judge to have an opinion where he's not letting it in, and every other attorney will see that and incite that case law. And that's all it takes. So, I mean, and not just a Minnesota judge. It can be, as we saw in Sue's, it could be a Washington case. It can be anywhere in the country. And so they're looking to us, you know, to do this research and step up to the plate, which, from the defense's point, I think is a valid concern. So the other thing about this is, you know, I've been talking about the admissibility issue. That's really only half the coin. The other part is, once we get the evidence in there, and all the judges have been letting, you know, these traditional sciences in, they have. There's a few, you know, little quirks here and there, but they've been letting it in. Then once it actually gets into the courtroom, the judge is saying, well, this certainly meets the threshold of admissibility. The questions about error rate and reliability and precision and accuracy, ask that during cross-examination. Yet again, a good thing, because then the jury has an opportunity to now hear about the weaknesses of the evidence, the strength of the evidence, and weight that appropriately. And I think that's also an important thing. But what we want to be able to do is to be able to show a jury, we have this research, we have these studies that that can show this, as opposed to essentially just giving an opinion or, you know, trying to answer those questions, but without being able to back it up with the data and research that we need for that. Because ultimately, the jury or the judge has to weigh the appropriateness of this evidence, and we want to go in and testify and be neutral and objective and give the appropriate weight to the evidence that's possible. We don't want to overextend ourselves or underestimate the value of the evidence, and research and study will allow us to give the appropriate weight to that evidence so that the judge or jury can make the right decision when they have to render that an all-important decision. So, that's my time. Thank you for the opportunity.
I'm sorry, Mr. Langenberger, yes. Did you explain the whole, you mentioned you were going to go into depth on the Fry issue, did you?
Mr. Chair, yes, sorry. Well, when I was talking about the admissibility hearings, because I'm assuming everyone here isn't familiar with all of the laws, but what I'm really talking about are either Fry hearings or Daubert hearings. Daubert is the federal standard which has been adopted by several states. I think about half the states in the nation have accepted a Daubert standard at the state level, and then there's a Fry standard, which we still are a Fry state. And Fry says the admissibility criterion is general acceptance, but there's also a court to that where in this state it's a Fry-Mack state. So there's a decision on record, and Mack throws in, yes, it's generally accepted, but also it's generally accepted to be reliable. And the Daubert test is determining reliability. So when we did have a Fry hearing here in Minnesota on fingerprints, it was essentially a Daubert hearing. I mean, for all intents and purposes, they asked us about error rates, they asked us about validation studies, they asked us about bias and error possibility, procedures, methods, and everything you'd expect to see in a full-blown Daubert hearing we had here. And the public defender's office has made it very, very clear that they're going to continue to challenge on these issues, and not just fingerprints, but all the other forensic identification sciences and more.
So, Mr. Langenberger, I'm just trying to get this clear so that in each case, your understanding of the public defender's office then is that on every case they will try to force proof of the whole reliability of the system, not just in this particular case that's in front of the court in that time. Is that your...
Sure.
And could you... I'm trying to...
Sure.
Find out exactly what you're saying.
Yeah, I think you can handle that, Mr. Chair. And I'm sure Pat will probably address more to that issue. But what I suspect will happen, what we've seen in some instances, is that they will raise the issue a number of times. There will be a number of opinions out there on admissibility. So we'll have those, assuming that judges continue to allow the evidence, we'll have those favorable opinions out there. They will probably, I don't know that for sure, ask Pat, but they will probably stop the admissibility hearings, or judges won't even have the hearings. They'll just say, well, I'm just citing this case law as acceptable. But even still, they can still ask those questions during the trial and attack the weight of the evidence, which also is appropriate for defense to do that. So just because we meet the admissibility challenges, those questions aren't going away. I mean, they can still raise in every single case, how reliable is this, where are your studies, what's your error rate, have you ever committed errors? I mean, all those types of questions, and frankly, I think those are fair questions in front of a jury as well. It's just our job to have that data and those studies to answer those for the jury. Does that help?
I think that helped. Your last part, I think it helped quite a bit on explanation of the real effect of just what was being done, but also how it would carry on anyhow and affect every case in the future, no matter what the short outcome on the admissibility issue was. Representative Cornish had a question.
Well, are we done with this?
Or you wanted to go back?
Well, I was wondering, we had a testimony about the intoxilizer and the accuracy. And I'm thinking, the studious group that we are, we shouldn't just take their word for it. I'm thinking of a test. And I know that the chairs of the public safety, finance and policy have some money that we could possibly bring some whiskey and some beer and maybe some mixed drinks and some wine and just have a committee meeting and see what we actually... come out on the Richter scale on that thing.
Representative Barnish,
Chair now,
is this a cheap way to get a lot of liquor for legislators? Or,
we might have to change our policy in the state office.
Mr.
Chairman Mulry, Frank Dolish, we have actually done that for legislative groups. If you're interested and want to be able to arrange a what we used to refer to as a drinking session, so you can see, we used to do this with our actual training of police officers. An idea was to give them an idea of what it actually feels like to be a .1 or a .08 in your own experience, and then also to actually see how the thing works in the real world. If people are interested, something like that could be arranged and at your convenience.
Mr. Dolish, I think Representative Cornish would like a setup for every week at least.
I took that course 5 times before I passed.
And this time he'll flunk it every time, every day he takes it. Representative Lash.
I have done that test twice as well. The last time they dosed me to a .13, and trust me, you can tell a difference in how I behave in committee at a .13. But in the name of science,
it's a better word.
I'd encourage all of us to be dosed to an appropriate level so we can know what we're talking about with the tax wise. So I second the motion.
Mr. Dolish, that raised an interesting question that I've seen a lot of in the last few years on. You say that so that you'll know what it's... my understanding from more recent studies over the last few years is that people change, and what level may have affected you at one point in your life affects you in a different way for some people at another point in their life. Isn't that the latest studies, aren't they?
Representative Mulry, that's probably true. Your drinking experience, your state of health, there's a lot of things that influence that. And really, the whole reason for picking the .08 in the first place is to set a level where anybody at that level should not be driving, and it'll affect their driving to the extent that you shouldn't be on the road. There's some of us that probably shouldn't be out there at a .03 because we're teetotalers, and that much would affect our driving.
Mr. Chair. Representative Hellstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's my understanding that, I don't know if you did it, but previously some other group actually got a few legislators to the point, had them drive periodically on a driving course as they were getting more and more intoxicated so that someone could actually see. I don't know if that was the State Patrol who did that, but I believe Rich Stanek was in there. But I would caution you that it was printed in the paper how many drinks it took him to get to the limit. So
it was printed?
It was printed in the paper how many drinks it took him to get to the legal limit.
Our new sheriff.
Chairman, Representative Brent may know a little bit about that.
Mr. Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, I believe it was done in conjunction with the State Patrol. They have a closed course up near St. Cloud. State Patrol often conducts controlled drinking sessions for field sobriety testing and for driving purposes on that controlled course.
Mr. Nelson, is that the same course that they use for teaching? For instance, I was up at a course near St. Cloud on teaching how to drive a car off the road and things like that, hitting near the engine, back edge and things.
Mr. Chairman, yes, it's also where they do instruct some of the defensive driving skills that it takes to operate.
First of all, did anybody else have questions of Mr. Langenberger? He slipped out. In the dark of night. Mr. Dolish, continue.
The only other issue that I had was a handout that I passed out. It's informational. During last session, this body in legislation created a new board called the Forensic Laboratory Advisory Board. I just wanted to update you. The last appointment to that board was made a few weeks ago by the governor. At the end of the last page of the handout that I gave you is a list of the appointees that board will be meeting on February 5th at the BCA for their first meeting. And so, again, this is just for informational purposes. They will be reporting back as required by that statute on a number of issues. And I see we've pretty much taken up the time that we promised we would take today, and I don't want to impinge on Mr. Sullivan's presentation.
The loyal opposition. Mr. Bellish, did you sneak one past me this morning? I asked a question, and you said that he'll be, and I can't remember his name, you said he would be at the at my hearing this afternoon and would answer the question, and so then I held back. And now I don't see him here.
Oh, that was Glenn Harden, who is the supervisor of our toxicology group. He had a family matter that he had to attend to, kind of emergency. So actually Brent is here in his place.
So I can ask him?
Yes, you may.
Okay. I thought maybe that was a tricky way to get around something. My question was, I'm seeing some national studies that show that some drugs, as far as causing accidents, there's a number of, we go after the drugs like alcohol and some of the sleep ones, heroin, whatever, that kind of slow the reactions down. There's some studies show that drugs like huge amounts of caffeine or that kind of a speed that gets you really up actually cause a lot of serious accidents, maybe even more than the others, and yet we're not really doing much because they turn people on into taking chances or going through stop signs or driving faster or being more aggressive. I don't know if you've, and I don't know the quality of those studies. Have you followed those at all, and do you think we should be looking into that whole issue here?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes, there have been a number of studies on stimulant use and over-the-counter medication use. Some drugs that are contained in over-the-counter medications, such as like dextromethorphan, which is a cough suppressant, is now being used by teenagers to get hot. It has a angel dust or PCP type effects, which is a terrible drug. The hallucinations, you have to use massive amounts of the drug, and they have all kinds of different effects on you, most of them very negative. With stimulants like methamphetamine, the argument is that it makes you a better driver, your reaction time. But it does have very detrimental actions to your body and to one's ability to drive a car. And that can happen through any of the course of that drug dosing, whether it's while you're under the influence of the methamphetamine or if you've been binging on methamphetamine for a number of days and you're in the crash phase of the withdrawal. Sometimes that's the most detrimental to your driving. Stimulant use can affect your risk-taking, your speed. Illegal stimulants like cocaine can increase your paranoia, so you're willing to flee police officers, maybe not even a police officer, maybe another car. Affects your judgment and your reasoning and all those actions that are incorporated in the task of driving. We have concentrated more on those CNS depressants that affect divided attention skills, such as alcohol or opiates. But driving is a very complicated task, and what is affected is more than just your ability to do more than one thing at one time. You can see a divided attention can be disrupted in driving with cell phone use and other distractions that can occur. But stimulant use also can be very detrimental to one's ability to drive a car. And the medications that can affect your ability to drive aren't necessarily always controlled or scheduled.
non-prescription drugs or even some prescription medications. Ambien is a new one. Zolpidem. When you first take that, until you adapt and build a tolerance up to it, can be extremely impairing for your ability to stay awake and for your ability to drive a motorized vehicle. A lot of the medications, a number of the antipsychotics, antidepressants, if you look at them, they will say, do not operate machinery or drive a car until you know how this medicine will affect you. It's not going to, doesn't mean you're going to be affected at all points in time. Once you build up a tolerance, you certainly will be able to function and drive fairly safely. But again, that's going to be kind of personally dependent. It may change for different people.
Okay, thank you. I guess we better get to Mr. Sullivan. Mr. Dolish, I was, and I guess you didn't maybe have the time to put everything together. I went to that Attorney General's presentations on the different things, and there was quite a bit covered in that that wasn't covered today. From maybe could you get the PowerPoint handouts from those three experts and get them to our committee so that at least they have them, that they could read some of the high points?
Yes, Chairman Mulray, we will do that. Actually, these three people are here, so we will get their PowerPoint presentations.
Okay.
And we just didn't feel we had the time to go through
that. Yes, I understand
that.
We want to.
We will do that.
Let Mr. Sullivan have some time too. Mr. Sullivan, state your name and the.
Oh, Patrick Sullivan. I'm a position. Senior attorney, and I'm supposedly in charge of forensic science litigation for the Hennepin County Public Defender's Office.
Okay, and basically, we asked you to present some of the problems you see that come up in forensics and the defense side of a lot of the issues.
Thank you. What I do and what I've done for a number of years, and that's why I said supposedly in charge, is kind of like herding cats with a bunch of lawyers. I'm there available when people bring me a question about forensic science, and usually it's about DNA. And I've been doing this since 1989. I've been a public defender for about 31 or 32 years. And I was the person who brought probably all the FRI hearings that you've read about over the years. Now there's some other people bringing FRI hearings. But we bring FRI hearings when we think there's a legitimate reason to do it. And in the beginning, you know, when you hear about DNA now, I always think back to 1989 in my first case when the private company which started all this reported that if you had a three-locus match in RFLP, the random match probability was 1 in 7 trillion. And, of course, this three-probe match, you know, would never occur among two people, so we had proof of absolute identity. We'd have to worry about that anymore. But now, of course, we all know that that isn't true. And as we started challenging these things, laboratories like the BCA, when they came online, started doing 5 and 6 locus probes, and then they were doing 9 locus probes under the old system. And some people still weren't satisfied. We're still going out and finding in databases two people that would match at 9 locus. So when we're doing these things, we're not, at least personally, no one in the public defender's office is doing this because, you know, we want to have something to do and we want to spend your money. We're doing this because we think they're, although we appreciate getting your money, but we don't do that. We have plenty of other things to do. We're doing it because we think there's legitimate reasons, and that's why we brought the FRI hearings. And we, of course, we've been successful. At first, the Supreme Court outlawed DNA testing in the first case because we weren't, the private laboratory didn't turn over to us the information that we needed to you know, determine whether or not we could make a challenge. So that's why we won the first case way back in 1989. So the first challenge we made was successful. Other challenges we've made have been successful and some haven't been successful. We've challenged the SGR testing that they're doing now at the BCA in several FRI hearings over the years. And
Mr. Sullivan, could you, like, I'm not sure, I don't know what STR is, and
okay.
You're using a lot of words, I'm not quite sure everybody on the committee is totally aware of.
Right. Well, I thought since you've been at the DCA this morning, when you you may have known, but when you were viewing the kind of testing they're done now, it's called short tandem repeat DNA testing, and that's STR testing. Everything is initials nowadays. And we challenged that in a number of FRI hearings. But when we were challenging it, we weren't challenging the basic science. Just like when we were challenging in the FRI hearing in the Schwartz case, when we were arguing before the Supreme Court, the Chief Justice stopped me immediately and said, well, the question is DNA testing generally accepted in the scientific community? I assume the prosecution says yes. What do you say? I said yes. And I won the case because the issue wasn't whether the scientific test is valid. It's what's the forensic application? Does, you know, what does it really prove? Can we get the discovery to intelligently answer the question? And for STRs, when we challenged it basically, I don't know if the courts understood this, but we tried to make it really clear that we were challenging two basic areas. One, when there's very small amounts of DNA, and I'm talking very small, and two, when there are mixtures. And you've got to keep in mind that the testing they're doing at the BCA involves, the manufacturer wants them to test one nanogram, which is a billionth of a gram of DNA. And so we were concerned about where they maybe have a tenth or a fifth that much DNA or smaller. We were concerned about those kinds of testing where they have very tiny amounts of DNA, because when you have very tiny amounts of DNA, the test can go out of whack and things can appear and disappear. And I see a lot of looks on people's faces, and in 20 minutes it's kind of hard to explain all the issues that are out there. So I'm just trying to explain that there are legitimate issues out there. The other thing is mixtures. It's very difficult to determine. In fact, you can never say that a person is in a mixture. You can never say that a mixture is only two people. You can never say that a mixture is three people. The BCA always would say that it's a mixture of two or more. It's always two people. Sometimes when you look at mixtures, you'll get a report that says, well, the defendant and the victim are possible contributors to the mixture or are included in the mixture, and sometimes they'll attach a number to that, but sometimes they'll say the defendant can't be excluded as being a person in the mixture. And on its face, when you look at the report, if you're a defense lawyer, you think, well, that means my defendant's in the mixture. He can't be excluded from being in the mixture. This is DNA, therefore he's in the mixture. But several times, for example, I've looked at cases using the software that the state's purchased for me, which is very expensive. And looking at the test, you realize that, and this is kind of hard to get your, mind around, it might be true that the defendant can't be excluded from the mixture, but in some cases, he can only be in the mixture if there's a third person in the mixture. But that doesn't jive with the statements of all the witnesses. So what we're doing, what I do in my office, is I look at the laboratory notes, the electropherograms that they produce, the electronic data. I look at that all as just like a police report. There are facts in there, and do the facts, fit the crime? So those are some of the things we're doing in the 400 or 500 cases, that I personally reviewed for public defenders around the state of Minnesota. And these issues are going to continue to come up. People are I used to go to court and talk about small amounts of DNA. Then scientists started to talk about low copy number DNA, and now it's called LCM. It now has initials. And people are questioning whether low copy number DNA is really suitable and whether validation has been done for it. So, there are legitimate questions. In mixtures, I see the BCA doing different things with mixtures now when they interpret them. So I think mixtures and low copy DNA, are things that are in flux. And we're still going to be, maybe not having FRI hearings about this, but we're still going to be litigating this, I will see cases where they say the defendant can't be eliminated from the mixture, but, when I look at the file, I'll see they're only using one-third of the test results to say he's not eliminated, because when you look at the other two-thirds, he's not there. But, you can spend hours on this sort of stuff. And what I like to do is I like to examine the data and rely on the people from the BCA to be my witness, because, of course, they're the best witnesses for the defendant. So I usually try to bring these things out through the BCA people without calling additional witnesses. So when I want the BCA people to come and testify, most lawyers don't want to see the BCA people come and testify. They don't want to ask anybody any questions about science. Most lawyers, I think, want to stipulate. If I want a BCA person to be there, it's because I want to ask them these questions that I may have, you know, about a particular case. There are issues now out there involving these large databases that are kind of interesting to scientists and myself and maybe some people from the BCA, but not generally interesting to the general public. But there's a question about what's the significance of a match if you've looked at a large, you know, database to find the match. In a normal situation, you might find a person running down the street. The police grab the person and arrest him because they think he committed the crime. Then they check his DNA, make a comparison, and they say, well, what's the chance that a randomly selected person would match? But in these database situations, you know, you're making comparisons to a large database of people. And something that you'll hear frequently from people who talk about statistics is the birthday comparison. And you know that a birthday, the frequency of a birthday is about, you know, 1 in 365, because that's how many days of the year there are. But if you've got a room, the question is, well, what's the chance that two people in the room are going to share the same birthday? And because you're making comparisons, say me to person one, myself to person two, and everyone in the room, then you take person two and you compare that person to everyone in the room, it actually turns out that once you have 23 people in the room, there's a 50% chance that two people have the same birthday because you're making so many comparisons. And in these database cases, you heard the numbers just from Minnesota. You know, you might have, say, 100,000 people, and you might have, you might have 100,000 cases that are being compared to this database at any one time. And I don't know if I've got my zeros right, but there might be, at some point, I'm sure there will be 10 million people in the database. So it turns out you're making a billion comparisons when you're doing that. So you're not just comparing me to the evidence. You're comparing my case, you know, you're comparing me to the evidence in one case, and then maybe another 100,000 cases, and then the other people who are in the database with me to the 100,000 cases. And you're making something like a billion comparisons. So if you look at it that way, and then you look at the fact that, let's say the random match probability is 1 in a billion, just for simplicity's sake. Well, that means that there's a 100% chance, and this isn't exact science, but there's a pretty good chance somebody is going to match just by chance. And in fact, in Great Britain, where they've expanded the databases, and I'm sure this is something that I doubt that there's been testimony about this, but in Great Britain, they've expanded the databases as the legislature has in the case recently declared unconstitutional. When you arrest somebody for probable cause, they'll take a sample. When you arrest somebody for a misdemeanor, they'll take a sample. So in Great Britain, they think that by arresting people by testing people who are just arrested or committing minor crimes, they're going to identify sort of the criminal element, and then they'll have a database of the criminal element. So I think they have about 5% of the population of Great Britain in these databases, and they're getting these databases, and they're getting many, many, many hits. But I saw a document from the Scotland Yard, essentially, the Home Office, that said, don't charge anybody based on the cold hit alone, go out and do an investigation. Because as these databases get to be so large, and we're taking all sorts of minor crimes and making comparisons where we have DNA, we're going to get hits that are just a coincidence. So don't charge anybody, go out and do an investigation first, which has always been my belief. And in fact, all scientists, we've been fighting about this in court, and it's on appeal. All scientists who are not working for the BCA or the FBI say that you have to do something different. And without getting into it, there's three different camps that you should have a different statistical method of describing the database search to take all this into account. But, you know, the BCA has chosen not to do that. So that's one of the things we're litigating. And it's important because, you know, some people advocate universal DNA databases, and then we're all in the soup together. And if we're all in the soup, there's certainly going to be coincidental matches, and we're all going to have to remember where we were in 1985. And it's serious because there's a case on appeal now where the victim got on the witness stand and said, that man right there, I've never seen him before in my life, he's not the rapist. But the DNA said he was, and he was convicted. I know another case in Great Britain where a person was arrested, the DNA matched him, spent 7 years in prison, and the victim testified, I know this man, and he's not the man that raped me. But he was convicted anyway based on the DNA. That was in Scotland. I got a chance to look at the test results, and you could see an obvious error. And I'm sure Mr. Iverson, who was doing that kind of testing, would spot the error in a minute. But no one testified for the defendant. So this is why, you know, we're here. This is why we're doing these things, because as these databases get bigger and bigger, you know, it could potentially impact all of us. There's other things that we're looking for in laboratory files, and that's, you know, the possibility of lab error. And I don't want anything that I say to be interpreted as being as saying that the BCA laboratory is a bad laboratory. So they're probably raising up behind me right now. But mistakes do happen at the BCA laboratory. And the BCA laboratory does let me come over and look at their files where they collect the mistakes that happen. But not many other lawyers go over there and look. But I went over and looked at a 12-month period and found that I think it was about in 7% of cases, there was DNA, say, from an analyst in a control that was supposed to be blank. Or there was a mix, there was a sample that was supposed to be a known sample from one person that had DNA from two people in it. There were about 7 cases in 3 incidents where DNA was transferred from one case to another by mistake. Years ago, I had this happen in a case about 10 years ago where DNA got transferred from one case to another by mistake. And we hadn't really seen it again. But I think because of the way they were doing things at the BCA and analyzing more than one case at one time, they were actually having samples from different cases at the same time. But you have to remember that they're trying to load a billionth of a gram into their mixture to test. And smaller amounts of DNA can transfer quite easily. So you can be the most careful scientist in the world, and you can be following protocols exactly and doing everything right, and still the stuff can get out. It can go from one case to another. We just recently had a case in December where it was a cold hit. And when I was examining the cold hit, I saw a note in the file that said, wrong sample injection. Well, I went and I looked further, and I saw that the sample was run more than once for legitimate reasons, and I could see that there were 2 different profiles for the same sample. And it didn't match my client, but then I saw they re-extracted the sample and got it, you know, they sort of had one profile, then another, and they re-extracted it and got another profile, and they proceeded on with that. So they sort of went back to the drawing board and did it again. And then when I raised my questions about it, they went back a third time and did it again. But I was curious about this note, wrong sample injection, and I got more files. I waited, insisted on getting every file I could, and I found out that a person had made a mistake and somehow transferred DNA from one case to another, I think back in 2001. And it happened to be a gentleman that I represented, one of my first STR cases. And so I was able to look at my data and see that they had these 2 cases being worked on at exactly the same moment. What was interesting is that something went wrong. A person went on maternity leave. No one could explain what happened. But somehow that other profile got sent out to the local police. The local police went out and interviewed this other defendant for the same case. They and question him. He's in prison because he's in a convicted offender database. So they question him about this other cold hit, whether he did it. They took the picture of the person to the victim and asked her if he was the person who did it. And she said no. But, of course, we don't know if that's going to matter or not. But when the BCA, it took a while, but when the BCA got back to finishing up the process and getting everything okay, they realized that they caught the mistake. And in fairness to the BCA, all the mistakes that I've mentioned, and yesterday in the mail, in discovery in another case, I got another year's worth of things, and these kind of things are still going on. There were about a dozen, maybe over a 12-month period, of some kind of questionable thing that the BCA caught. Well, what concerns me as a defense lawyer is if they can take DNA and transfer it from one case to another, if it's a blank that now has DNA in it, you can catch that. If it's a sample from one person that is two persons, that's a mixture, you can catch that. But the question then becomes, what if they transferred the DNA from the known of the defendant into the evidence by mistake? Well, you can never catch that. So that's why I think we're concerned, and that's why, we've got to be able to hire experts. That's why we've got to, the software that I use costs $10,000, and the upgrade costs $2,500, and the company that sells it won't support it for defense lawyers. They'll just take our money. So it's a very interesting way to do it. I wanted to mention something because Mr. Langenberger said that the defense is going to continue to raise Fry issues about identification, and he's right. I personally didn't have anything to do with the fingerprint one, but there are identification sciences like forensic odontology, where they match your bite mark. There are people that will match your shoe print, like the Bruno Magli shoe, and I didn't have that much to do with OJ, but the Bruno Magli shoe that OJ was wearing. There were people who would testify. They go around the country and testify, not only can I tell it's a Bruno Magli shoe, but I can tell you were wearing it. There were people who would testify that they could match bite marks to a person. There were people who could testify to all sorts of things. And gunshot residue, of course, we see that every week on CSI, is gunshot residue. And there's an article in Science, The Coming Paradigm Shift in Forensic Identification Science. And Science is the most prestigious scientific journal in the United States and possibly the world. And they did a study of these cases where DNA, which is now the gold standard, not just for science, but for defense lawyers, because never before had defense lawyers challenged scientists. And when I first did it, people thought it was crazy. But never before it had been done. And the question is, what the study claims, and there may be people who disagree with it, but they have data that shows that in 63% of the wrongful convictions, there was faulty forensic science that contributed to it. And I'm proud to say only 19% was the defense lawyer asleep. But it was 63% forensic science. And so when you look around at forensic science, it's true that there, for most identification sciences, there is no study that says that, I can tell that this gun fired this bullet necessarily. I'm not sure, that's not an expert on that. But the FBI went around for years testifying that they could tell that a bullet came out of a box of bullets. So that if they then found a box of bullets in the defendant's home, they could tie him to that shooting. Well, the National Academy of Sciences got involved because people questioned whether that was true or not, and now it's been abandoned, and the FBI has admitted that it's not true. And hundreds of people had testimony in their cases. It was never challenged. So that's kind of frightening that people aren't challenging these identification sciences. Now, I think Mr. Langenberger, to his credit, is doing a validation study for fingerprints, even though it's been out there for 100 years. And the reason it's being challenged is because there's so many instances of people who have been falsely matched to fingerprints. The Seattle lawyer who was linked to the Madrid bombing was because of a fingerprint match that was made by the top people at the FBI, not some guy who didn't know what he was doing. And I was familiar with a case in Scotland, or in England, where a person was matched to a fingerprint And then later on, after they arrested him, the crimes kept happening. They caught another guy, and he matched the fingerprint, too. They didn't match each other, but they both matched the fingerprint using their points of comparison. And so recently, there was a double homicide here in the metro area a few years ago, and in Anoka County, and the police stopped everybody who was leaving the scene of the double homicide, and they stopped him in cars, and they brought him to the police station, and they tested him all for gunshot residue. Based on the testing for gunshot residue, which was presented to the grand jury in the form of a report where nobody testified. Now, this wouldn't happen at trial, but you can do things like that in the grand jury, I think. But the report said this. Well, having a positive test for gunshot residue means you either fired a gun, you were near a gun when it was fired, or you handled a gun or contaminated ammunition. So that was read. That was just given to the grand jurors. And I think five people were indicted for two counts of first-degree murder. And in large part, it was based on that evidence, that they were there when the gun was fired and they fired a gun. And there was a lot of gunshot going on. And there was five defendants, five different attorneys, and one happened to be from our office. And so he filed a motion for a Fry hearing, the only one. And he came to me and he said, now what do I do? I said, well, let's find out something about gunshot residue, because I didn't know anything about it. So I started reading about it and finding out that the FBI is looking into this. There are questions about what you can say about gunshot residue. And in fact, it was at this point pretty well known that all you could say is a person was in an environment of gunshot residue, meaning he could be in a police station, because a police station might be an environment of gunshot residue. Might be touched by a police officer. That would be in being in an environment of gunshot residue. So I looked around for an expert witness, and I found a person who graduated from St. Thomas many years ago named John Kilty. So I called Mr. Kilty on the phone, and he founded the FBI's gunshot residue program way back when, and he ran the program and the metallurgy program for 18 years. And I left him a voicemail that says, I want to have a Fry hearing on gunshot residue. And I think, as I'm from St. Thomas, too, maybe he knew that instinctively. He called me up, and he was kind of worried. He said, you want to challenge the scanning electron microscope? And I said, no, I want to challenge these people going and saying that just because you test positive for something, that means you fired a gun or were near a gun when it was fired. That is no longer accepted by gunshot residue experts. And he said, well, I agree with that. So we got all the police reports, and I sent them out here, and here's what happened in the case. One of the cases, there was a conviction that's on appeal, but what happened in the case was the police stopped the people, and they brought them all to the police station. And a policeman did something that turned this investigation into kind of a controlled experiment. The policeman said, well, I want to make sure everybody goes to the bathroom, make sure everybody washes their hands. So there's a person who testified at the grand jury that everybody washed their hands before they had a gunshot residue test. And the thing about gunshot residue is it can wash off, and it does wash off. It can fall off. It can be deposited in different places. It's very sub-microscopic, and you need a very expensive microscope to do this test, which costs about $200 a test. So there were several thousand dollars spent testing everybody. And even though everybody washed their hands, and then they remained in a police station for 4 hours, they were all positive, I believe. The front and the back of every hand was positive. And what had happened? Well, we don't know where it came from, but we know they all washed their hands. And in fact, our client, the officer, was very impressed that he had scrubbed his hands up to the elbows after he used the bathroom. And so we had a great experiment. But then what happened was, well, once they came out of the bathroom, the same policeman who had been watching them put the handcuffs back on. So then he went to the next person, patted him down, took the handcuffs off. Person went into the bathroom, came back out, put the handcuffs back on. Then they had people sitting on the floor in the police station because there were like 13 people. They had people sitting on benches touching each other. They had people, they'd all been at the scene of the shooting, and they'd all been in cars where there could have been some shooters jumping into cars leaving the scene. So everyone could have had gunshot residue on their clothing. So then they were wearing their clothing, and they would go into the room where the testing was done, and they would have them wear the clothing, and then they would have them change clothing in the room, so then the gunshot residue could be spread around the room. So the police officers, of course, had no training. They were just getting a test that was purchased at a from a company. Then the representative of the company comes in to testify, and he, I know we're probably running out of time.
Yeah. Mr. Solomon, can you wrap it up, because
yeah,
we are a ways off.
What happened is the person came in to testify from the company, and he sort of changed it a little. He wouldn't say what he told us on the phone, but he still wanted to kind of just add another, he wanted to minimize the business about, all you can say it's an environment gunshot residue. He's being paid about $200 an hour. He works for the company that sells and manufactures the scanning electron microscope. And when asked what his educational background was, he said, well, I guess my greatest experience was all the work I did working for Dr. So-and-so and Dr. So-and-so and Dr. So-and-so. Which I thought was kind of odd, because that doesn't really answer the question. So I asked him, well, you didn't go to college, right? He's a high school graduate. He's had no training, done no studies, and he's testified all over the country about all sorts of things that were now no longer generally accepted. The FBI no longer does gunshot residue testing, in part because they found gunshot residue all over their gunshot residue testing laboratories. So there's real legitimate reasons, and it can cost money to challenge. So, thank you.
Okay, thank you. We kind of, well, we don't have very many left, anyhow. We're the next group is ready to come in, so we are adjourned.